Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome with us today students from Waupaca High School. Would they please stand? And their faculty. Good. Thank you very much for coming. Anytime, but especially today. With our roads bad and the snowstorm and cold. The Waupaca High School students are with us with our Court with Class program that's sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. They have received briefs about the case, and they may have gotten other materials and met with the people to discuss the case we're about to hear. And at noon, they will be joined with the Sheboygan Area Lutheran High School students to hear a presentation by a justice. You're all welcome to attend that noon session. The discussion will be about the procedures of the court, not about the substance of the case we have heard this morning, previously, or this one. So we've met you. I want to introduce the court to you all. I will start on my far right with Justice Prasa, who will be the justice you will meet with at noon. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And seated to my immediate right is Justice William Bablich. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice John Wilcox. And to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. With those introductions made, we turn our attention to the second case this morning, 010784, Conway versus Board of Police and Fire Commissioners. We will hear from Aaron Halstead, representing Joseph Conway, for 25 minutes and then a rebuttal. And we'll hear from Carolyn Hogg and for 20 minutes and Scott Herrick for 10. Okay. Mr. Halstead.
Thank you, and may it please the court. I'm Aaron Halstead, and I represent Joseph Conway, Jr. and the International Association of Firefighters, Local 311, the petitioners in this case. That is the IAFF local in the city of Madison. I sat in on the first hearing in this case, and so I've heard chapters 6213 mentioned more than ever, and that's what this case, of course, deals with, although a quite different issue. Chapter 62 of the statutes requires that all cities in the state with a population of over 4,000 citizens create a board of police and fire commissioners comprised of five persons. The members of those boards are personally appointed by the elected mayor of the city and are charged with many tasks, among those being hearing and deciding disciplinary cases brought against subordinate police officers and firefighters. In this case, the City of Madison's Board of Police and Fire Commissioners has promulgated a rule that relates to those disciplinary hearings, and that is Rule 7.20. That rule permits the City of Madison Board of Police and Fire Commissioners to delegate to persons other than themselves, that is, those appointed by the mayor, to delegate to those other persons their statutory obligation to hear cases involving the discipline of subordinate police and firefighters. The responsibilities that are assigned to these other persons who are denominated as hearing examiners by the Madison PFC include deciding discovery issues at the pre-hearing stage and resolving procedural motions, presiding over and conducting evidentiary hearings, including the right to question witnesses, and of necessity, rule on evidentiary objections that arise during those hearings, and any motions that might arise during those hearings, and following the hearing to prepare a comprehensive report to the board that includes an evaluation of witness credibility and demeanor evidence, and then to make a recommendation to the board regarding a proposed disposition of the charge that has been brought against the firefighter or the police officer.
Mr. Halstead, isn't it clear that while the hearing examiner does these things and makes a recommendation, that the ultimate decision is one to be made by the Police and Fire Commission itself?
I think that there is no question that the City of Madison Board has reserved to itself the right to make the final decision in the case. And we would submit, though, Justice Crooks, that by delegating these wide tasks, these broad-ranging tasks to these hearing examiners, that in effect the board, while reserving to itself the right to make the final decision, has let loose to the hearing examiner many of the things that that are critical to a decision maker in making these. And those include, for example, being present while the hearing is being conducted and actually observing the witnesses and drawing credibility and demeanor inferences for the board itself.
Isn't there a videotape made of the proceedings before the hearing examiner so that that can be reviewed by the Police and Fire Commission?
Yes, there is a videotape that is made. However, as I've indicated, as the rule provides, the examiner is charged in making that comprehensive report following the conducting of the hearing, with including in that report recommendations for the disposition that are based upon specific credibility inferences that the examiner has drawn based upon witnesses and their demeanor. And that certainly, we believe, suggests that if the board in each of these cases intended to sit down and to look at, you know, watch the entire proceedings, including the videotape, then the board is not going to ask that it be informed as to the hearing examiner's conclusions regarding the credibility of those witnesses. So while there is a videotape that's been prepared, it seems to us that one of the things that this rule, an inference that arises from it, is that the board is not obligating itself to take a look at the videotape of the proceedings in each of these cases. And certainly one of the things that's been argued here, as I understand the brief of the city and of the board, is that it's an efficiency issue, potentially. At least that's an argument that's being made. And so while that is available, it seems to us that many of the things that the legislature has charged the board itself with doing, it's having someone else do.
If I could just follow up for a minute. One of the cases that was heavily relied on by the Court of Appeals was the Tecumseh Products case. And basically, as I understand it, that's a case that says due process doesn't require that the person making the final decision be the person before whom the evidence is presented. Now, how do you get around that case? Are you claiming a due process violation here?
Our challenge to this rule, Justice Crooks, at no point that I can recall have we made an argument that relates to due process. And I agree that the Tecumseh case, and there are many other cases that state the proposition that when state agencies began to rely upon more and more hearing examiners, there were challenges that were made to those proceedings which contended that because the person who was hearing the case wasn't the same person that was deciding it, then the ultimate decision maker wasn't getting the benefit of the hands-on, in-person proceedings. And the court said, well, the legislature, as long as the hearing examiner prepares, for example, what in an agency such as the Labor and Industry Review Commission would call a memorandum, a credibility memoranda to the commission itself, then that solves any due process issue. Our contention here is that there simply is not the power to delegate that task to this examiner, that the board has been charged with doing a very specific thing, which is to hear and decide these cases, and that it is giving to someone else, mentioned nowhere in the statute, other than in 6M, which I'll talk about later, mentions giving that responsibility to no one else. And so I would not rely on due process. And I think that it reflects the fact that the board is relying on someone else to make that decision for them, shows what they've given up when they've given up this process.
So your real argument is that 6213.5G is just not broad enough to authorize what's occurred here. Is that correct?
Absolutely. In fact, 6213.5G, which allows the board to make rules necessary to administer the statute, and I believe that Judge Krieger also touched on this, there are rules and then there are rules. There are rules that regulate the proceeding, the procedure within the hearing itself. You know, who will go first, how many exhibits there will be, when you exchange them, when motions will be filed. And then there are rules that are substantive, that substantive really are legislation, which is we've decided we're going to have a hearing examiner and we're going to make a rule. I think this is not really a rule that was contemplated under 5G.
So you think that this would be different, as you know, cities, communities under 4,000 would be able to do this, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. The statute specifically says.
And so it's the lack of specificity in the statute, and that's why your argument in answer to Justice Crook's question is that, look, if it isn't there, it isn't there, and this court should stick with that.
Correct.
What are the ramifications to past cases if we were to hold in your favor, past cases that have employed the hearing examiner?
In this particular case, and Mr. Herrick can correct me if I misspeak, but the challenge was brought, 7.20 was promulgated, I believe, in 1999, and the declaratory judgment action was filed before any hearings were ever conducted under that rule. And so I'm not aware of any case in which this occurred. I've been involved in police and fire commissions in different parts of the state, and I've never been involved in a proceeding where anyone other than the board itself within that municipality actually heard and decided the case. Hypothetically, if such a case had occurred somewhere, then I would suspect that the ramifications might be, I'd look at it in a couple of ways. One would be perhaps whether a challenge was brought to the use of the hearing examiner at the time that the proceeding went forward so that there could be a waiver or an estoppel kind of argument. And then in terms of could someone challenge that on due process grounds? I suppose if they objected to it at the time and then acted within whatever period of statute limitations there might have been for challenging it or review proceedings, perhaps there could be a challenge brought.
Why did the Police and Fire Commission adopt 7.20?
I do not believe that there's a statement of purpose in the rule itself. And I'll be subject to correction on that, but I think that it just states that the board may engage a hearing examiner. And so what the purpose for the adoption of the rule was, I can't say with certainty. I know that one thing that was argued in the brief that Chief Amesqua filed with this court is that the adoption of this rule serves one of the two purposes of the that have been announced by this court, one of the two purposes of police and fire commissions, which is to ensure a speedy resolution of the matter for the subordinate officer. And, of course, as we've argued, actually what happens here is that you have created a two-tiered system which duplicates things that the board itself could and should have done initially without the need for that first level of the hearing examiner. Judge Krieger held that the board had and has no statutory authority to adopt this rule, and we set forth her reasoning in detail in our brief. We submit that Wisconsin precedent compels the conclusion that Judge Krieger reached in this case. This court's precedent, including in Racine Police and Fire Commission versus Stanfield, which is found at 70 West Second, treats a Board of Police and Fire Commissioners as an administrative agency. In other words, the precedent of this state's of this court's decisions treats it in the same way in terms of the scope of its powers as if you were to look at, for example, a state agency. Wisconsin administrative agencies, including the board, are creatures of statute, and therefore they have no power beyond that which the statute gives them. That power can come to an agency in one of two ways. Either the legislature can expressly give the power in the enabling statute, or it can be implied from the empowering statute. However, a finding that an administrative agency's powers are implied is heavily disfavored under Wisconsin law. As this court stated in the case that we cited, Kimberly Clark Corporation versus the Public Service Commission, any reasonable doubt as to the existence of an implied power in an agency must be resolved against the exercise of such authority. So there are two separate inquiries that the court must make in this case in deciding whether Rule 7.20 is valid. First, does Section 6213 expressly grant to the board the power to employ hearing examiners? And if not, has the board carried the heavy burden of convincing this court that that power must necessarily be implied from the statute? We suggest that the answer to each of these questions is no. First, no express authority exists. Nowhere in Section 6213, sub 1 through sub 5, does the legislature ever expressly authorize the board in a city of over 4,000 persons to delegate responsibility for conducting these disciplinary hearings to anyone other than the members appointed by the mayor.
Mr. Halstead, doesn't the Court of Appeals contradict that particular point that you just made by basically saying that there is express authority, and that express authority is in 6213.5G, which says that rules may be adopted by the commission in order to carry out the discipline that's set forth in the statute?
Justice Kurtz, we would respectfully disagree with the Court of – if my reading of the Court of Appeals opinion, if the Court intended to say that this is an express power, then we suggest that that was an incorrect conclusion. And we suggest that because actually what the Court of Appeals did was to say that the legislature expressly gave the power to make rules, and then from that power to make rules, the Court implied a power to employ hearing examiners. So it didn't actually find any type of express authority for the employment of hearing examiners. It derived that through implying a power from another express power. And so we would suggest that was not a finding of an express power.
Well, there's an express power to make rules, right?
There is.
Okay. So the issue is what kind of rules come within that express power to make rules?
I think that's I think that is a fair statement of the question.
And your position is that the authority to make rules does not include this kind of rule. It includes such things as what time they should hold hearings, where they might hold hearings, other kind of administrative matters that would assist in the carrying on of their business, but not this kind of substantive rule.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's your, if I understood your brief.
Absolutely. We would suggest that this is a rule only because it's been called a rule. It is the legislating of a situation where the board is allowed to use a hearing examiner and cloaking that situation in a rule in what's called a rule. There isn't anything that by necessity, and again I refer back to the Stanfield case, Racine Fire and Police Commission versus Stanfield, where the court talked about, and this was a case, of course, involving a police and fire commission, if you you must have a power that's either expressly conferred or which by necessity is implied from the four corners of the statute. And so in this case, we submit there is no express the legislature knew how to indicate that it wanted agencies to use hearing examiners because it's done so many times. In fact, right within the very statute, when we're talking about cities of the population under 4,000, it expressly said that in those cities, if you choose not to create a board of police and fire commissioners, then you may appoint a three-person committee, or you may appoint a single individual who shall act in place of the board under sub 5, which is the very section that applies in this case.
The Court of Appeals says this: Conway does not explain how the use of a hearing examiner appointed by the board under Rule 7.20 circumvents or diminishes the independent nature of the board. Accordingly, we don't consider this argument further. And my question is, what is your objection on a substantive matter, to the hearing examiner? The reason I ask that is maybe that will give a clue as to whether this is just part of rulemaking to help them do their job better, or really makes a substantial difference in how this board operates. Therefore, it's not a rulemaking, but really a legislative enact.
I think there are a couple.
And that's what I think you're trying to differentiate.
I think there are a couple ways I would approach it. And one is to just go back to the and I think the question you're posing, if I'm hearing it correctly, is why does it matter that they're doing this, or what's the problem with
right.
it?
Why are
first
you
of all,
objecting?
The first problem, I think, is that it's just not allowed. An administrative agency cannot decide what its powers will be.
Oh, I mean, besides the noble purpose of trying to uphold the law, right. which is saying it's not allowed, what is your, you know, why don't you like this?
The second way in which it can be looked at is this. In the city of Madison, there are five persons who have been personally appointed by the mayor. These are people who are chosen for whatever reasons the mayor or I believe that the terms of these members are staggered, but even if they're not, whatever mayor or mayors have appointed the people currently serving on the board, it was for a specific reason. The mayor wanted these people in this city and other cities to take care of discharging the statutory responsibilities that the legislature gives such a board. There's no indication here that in doing so, this mayor or any other mayor has said that they want other persons to be involved in this process. These are people who are completely foreign to the makeup of a board as contemplated by the legislature. So I think at least another possible objection to this is that there's something about for some reason these persons have been appointed to the board, and the court ought not allow the board to take some of these duties and give it to people who weren't appointed by the elected official.
Then that sounds as if your objection is that somebody other than these five people will be making a decision.
That's certainly, because there are decisions, and I would call them substantive decisions within the hearing itself, that will be made by these hearing examiners, whether it's one or two or however many people hear a particular case, because any time you decide an important issue, and it can be an evidentiary issue within a hearing or some type of procedural motion, those have substantive effects on parties. And that's to me, a real power that person is wielding in the disciplinary hearing process.
It sounds like an accountability issue.
That is a way of phrasing it. I think that the reason that the mayor is statutorily given the power to appoint these people is that they, in some way or another, are accountable to the mayor, who's accountable to the electorate, and these hearing examiners have no accountability to anyone, insofar as I can tell by looking at the Rule 7.20.
Well, are there comparable kinds of appointments made at other in other agencies or branches of government? For instance, I'm thinking, okay, the governor appoints
the DNR board, and everybody accepts that. And here we've got the parallel of the mayor appointing the PFC board. But then, as far as I know, the DNR board does not have authority to appoint something tantamount to hearing examiners. But what about other things in government? I know this is asking you to give me a question against your own interest, but have you thought about that?
Well, we've thought about it insofar as trying to look at every analogous situation in which the legislature has looked at a situation and said, here's a person who in some way, shape, or form has an employment-related right or entitlement or privilege at stake. And that might be a person who has an issue that arises under the Fair Employment Act, Workers' Compensation Act, Unemployment Compensation Act, or any of the statutes that are administered by the Employment Relations Commission. In those instances where the legislature has determined that it wants the commissioner or the secretary or the board to allow to have the power to employ other people to hear these cases, it said that that's what it wants to do. And it has not said so as to boards of police and fire commissioners in a city over 4,000. In terms of, I can't say that I have any knowledge or information about something outside of that scope. I've only thought about it in terms of in the employment context where you have these rights at stake.
But in the employment context, I'm not sure, but you cite in your brief 111.075, which gives, for instance, the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission authority to authorize a commissioner or examiner to make findings and orders and I don't know the answer to this, in workers' comp, in unemployment comp, in Chapter 111 proceedings. Do those hearing examiners have authority to issue findings and orders which then are procedurally appealable to the full commission?
Yes. In a workers' compensation statute, under the workers' compensation statute, an administrative law judge, under the unemployment compensation statute, the same, and under the Fair Employment Act, those are orders that are appealable to the Labor and Industry Review Commission.
But then isn't that distinction to be made here, although you use it as an analogy? Here we have 7.20, which does not authorize the hearing examiner to issue any kind of orders. Indeed, it is clear that it is the commission that is going to be the decision maker.
The commission will be the final decision maker in the city of Madison. However, what I would submit is that by the time the hearing examiner has gone and heard days of testimony and prepared a comprehensive report, including on witness credibility, made all of these decisions, then this report is laid in the lap of the respective members of the board, and I would submit that means something at that point. There's at least something that's carried with that wouldn't be there, almost a presumption, I would say, that wouldn't be there if the board in the first instance were hearing the case.
I have a question that goes to one that another justice asked. On these videotapes, which obviously exist, as a matter of practice, do they actually view these as part of their decision making? I'm talking about the Police and Fire Commission.
To date, as I understand, there's never been a hearing in which a hearing examiner has conducted a hearing under Rule 7.20, and so I don't think the situation has presented itself to the board.
Your argument relies heavily on the fact that all the way through the statute it says the board shall, the board does, the board this, the board that, and you're viewing that it's delegating authority.
Correct. Delegating responsibility for doing certain things that if we look at 6213 sub 1 all the way through sub 5, and again now you move on beyond that to 6M and you start talking about the city's underpopulation 4,000, and so you start talking about persons or committees besides the board, that the only entity that is mentioned in there, sub 1 through sub 5, is the board.
Would have a lawyer?
I'm certain that it does. Mr. Herrick, as I understand, advises the Madison PFC.
And does the board draft its own orders, or does it have a staff person do that?
I would assume that if the board has a staff person or an attorney who drafts the orders, that person drafts what the board instructs it to draft.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Hogg, Assistant City Attorney, representing the Fire Chief, Deborah Amis.
May it please the Court, good morning. I'm Carolyn Hogg, an Assistant City Attorney with the City of Madison, and I represent Respondent Fire Chief Deborah Amesquivus in this action. I will say that my co-respondent, PFC, is represented by Attorney Herrick, and I have proposed somewhat of a division of labor to make efficient use of our time, and I will preliminarily address the issues of statutory construction presented in this appeal, and Attorney Herrick, in his time, will address the issues of the rule itself, how that fits in to the statutory responsibilities of the PFC under 6213, paren 5, and how it is consistent with the obligations of that citizen board as memorialized in the statute and, in fact, in furtherance of its responsibilities. And
Ms. Hogg, in that regard, in regard to your area, statutory construction or interpretation, how do you get around the language in the Kimberly-Clark case to the effect that any reasonable doubt as to the existence of implied power in an agency must be resolved against the exercise of such authority? What's your answer to that?
Well, I think the first point that needs to be made is how you determine reasonable doubt. And I understand that the petitioners have cited and relied heavily on the Kimberly-Clark decision, and I don't think that presents a problem for the respondents in this matter. Because the first thing we need to look at is what does it mean that a rule is unreasonable. And this court, in the recent Cider case, I think decided in 2002, said that a rule is unreasonable if it is not in accordance with the language of the statute, that is to say, it conflicts with the language of the statute, or it conflicts with the intent. So this rule that there's a presumption, you must satisfy a presumption of reasonableness, must be viewed then in the context of 6213 paren 5, and just exactly what it is that the legislature intended. So I also think that the Kimberly-Clark decision stands in very sharp contrast when you take a look at the decision in that case with what the Court of Appeals decided in this case. I mean, obviously this is an issue of statutory construction, and at core it is discerning the intent of the legislature. Getting to the reasonableness issue, the rule is reasonable if it, in fact, it effectuates the intent of the legislature. It is unreasonable if it does not. Now, one of the ways that we determine whether something effectuates the intent of the legislature is to look at the language of the statute itself and the purpose for which the statute was enacted. In this case, I think the court has to look at 6213 paren 5 stats generally and what exactly the legislature intended to delegate to the PFC as part of its responsibilities in disciplinary proceedings, and 6213 paren 5G in particular, which is a specific grant of authority to make further rules for the administration of the statute. Now, it was the position of the Court of Appeals that in examining the statute, the court concluded, and I think Attorney Halstead misunderstands the Court of Appeals' decision in this instance. I believe the Court, in applying the Wisconsin hospital cases versus DNR, actually found there was express authority for the rule, and I think the Court applied that correctly. Basically, what the Court does in deciding whether there's express authority for rulemaking is to take a look at the elements of the statute that the agency is charged to administer and the elements of the rule. Now, the Chief Moskowitz, in looking at this, looked at the elements of the statutory delegation, that is to say, the authority to make rules for the administration of the subsection, and then looked at 7.20 and concluded that, in fact, this is a rule adopted by the PSC for the administration of its responsibilities to ensure that there's a due process hearing for any police and fire subordinate charged and brought before the PSC. The Court of Appeals went further, and the Court took a look at the elements of 62.5 generally. And the Court articulated those elements as to ensure that there is a public hearing that essentially satisfies the elements of due process in an administrative agency setting, a determination of just cause as to whether the violations in the complaint alleged are supported by just cause, the imposition of a penalty in the event that just cause is found, and the filing of a written decision. In addition, the Court noted was the general authority to grant rules, and the Court, using the definition in Webster's Dictionary as to what it means to make a rule regarding the administration of a statute, said, well, Webster says a rule regarding administration would be procedures and practices, techniques, and methodologies that assist an agency in fulfilling its obligations. Thank you. And the Court, examining Rule 7.20, concluded that, in fact, Rule 7.20 was such a rule.
Coming through the microphone, I'm sorry. It was a helpful thing, but good deeds don't go on.
Okay. I can't hear it myself.
Right,
okay. And the Court explicitly found that there was express authority for the rule. And I think that the point that Chief Justice Abrahamson was getting at with respect to what is an administrative rule, what is a rule for the administration of a statute, is an important point. Because if we take a look at the petitioner's point of view, you would never have express authority if you were given rulemaking authority. Once you made a rule, you're allowed to subpoena an individual. You can administer an oath that would then be viewed as an implied rule rather than express authority for the rule. And I think that's an incorrect application from or extrapolation from the Wisconsin Hospital Association case.
But if you take your position, counsel, you can say that any time you have authority to make a rule, every rule that is made, unless it's directly conflicting with the language, is okay. And that seems to me too broad.
Well, it still remains a rule for the administration of the subsection. So certainly the Court has to take a look as to whether this rule assists the PSC in administering the subsection. I disagree that a rule that allows the appointment of a hearing examiner is in the nature of a substantive rule such that it expands the jurisdiction or addresses the jurisdiction of the PSC. I think it is more in the nature of a civil procedure rule.
The point is not that it expands, basically.
Just hold your microphone, otherwise we can't hear you.
That it would, the argument of opposing counsel is, look, they don't look in the eyes of the witnesses. They do not, they're not there. They do not hear the inflections in the the exact wording of the question, which comes out on the sterile paper that they may read. So they, as you've attended many trials, it makes a difference whether you, and I'm certainly as a judge, know that when you're there listening to the testimony, it's different than when you read a deposition or do other things. So I think that's part of their argument, that is what is missing. How do you address that? That you weren't there, you're reading it in a transcript, basically.
I think two points need to be made on that issue, Justice Wilcox. First is the issue that you brought up yourself with respect to the Tecumseh case, and that is we have to take a look at what we're dealing with here, and what we are dealing with is what is effectively a due process hearing in an administrative agency setting. The courts have never found insufficient, as a matter of law, an administrative process, as illustrated by the Tecumseh case, where a board member doesn't hear the testimony firsthand. And that may very well be the preference of the individual who is the subject of the board's jurisdiction. But the issue is not the individual preference, but rather the board's authority to enact a rule. And I think what we need to focus on here, then, is exactly what the nature of the delegation is. I mean, first, taking a look at the statute, understand that the legislature, in enacting an ordinance, in enacting a statute, has the ability either to fully spell out the delegation to a particular agency, or to give a broad delegation to an agency and leave to the agency the job of filling in the details. In this instance, the legislature has given the PFC a very broad delegation.
Can you think of other areas in which the legislature, other agencies in which the legislature has, without giving express authority to use this kind of thing, has given such a broad power that the agencies have done this? Maybe I can make that clear. Mr. Halstead's brief points to a number of instances in which the legislature has given Wisconsin administrative agencies the authority to do precisely what is being done here. His point, obviously, is that they didn't give you the authority.
Mm-hmm.
So can you think of cases in which they haven't given express authority, yet nevertheless such authority is being exercised?
Well, in fact, that is the general rule. If you get back to what we're talking about, what we mean by the authority that's being delegated. You characterize it as such broad authority, but in fact...
That was your characterization. That was not mine.
Oh, I'm sorry. The authority being delegated from the PFC to the hearing examiner is in fact a narrow one. And the Attorney General opinion back in 1962, which I cite, in fact said that it is not unusual for an administrative agency to delegate to instrumentalities, and not to call Attorney Herrick an instrumentality, but to delegate to counsel the ability to do research for them and the ability for a hearing examiner to be delegated that.
Specific examples. Can you give me a specific example in which an agency, without being given express delegation of this power, has nevertheless practiced this and done what, in effect, the PFC is doing here?
I think that the Callahan case that was cited by the amicus in its brief is an example of that. And that case involved a school district and the superintendent, a public instruction, was involved in a quasi-judicial determination as to whether the a particular school district should be detached or disbanded and then attached to two adjoining school districts. And there, the Supreme Court took almost as a matter of course that this type of more narrow delegation, that is to say, delegate hearing, investigative, evidence gathering, report making to a hearing examiner, was almost part of modern practice in administrative law situations. It's cited in the Morgan case in my brief, United States versus Morgan, where the Supreme Court recognizes that it is part and parcel of an administrative agency's authority. So it would not surprise me that I couldn't think of more cases where this express authority, or rather the authority was exercised without an express authority, because it is viewed as being a fairly common exercise of administrative agency authority.
That may be when it's exercising executive powers or administrative powers. This is quasi-judicial powers.
That is correct.
And the question is, can a quasi-judicial board exercise its adjudicative powers by delegating to somebody else to hear the testimony and make recommendations? And of course, if you go to the courts as an example, courts can appoint masters to take testimony, make recommendations, hire staff to review materials and make recommendations. And the issue is, when does this delegation usurp the ultimate adjudicative function?
Well, I certainly think that the PFC, as any administrative agency, enjoys a presumption of regularity about its affairs. So I don't think that the court should presume that because it uses a hearing examiner for the limited function of conducting a hearing, that it will abrogate its responsibilities to make the final determination and impose the penalty.
What is, excuse me,
I wonder if it's the same question.
The
same, you go first.
The nature of the follow-up hearing, if you will, that is then conducted by the PFC. If the hearing examiner performs an adjudicative function by presiding over the initial hearing and the evidentiary hearing, collects the evidence, files a report containing credibility determinations and a recommendation for disposition. And as I read the rule, it says that after that, the board convenes for deliberations. Is that a hearing at which then there is further argument? I know it provides for further proceedings at the discretion of the board, but what is contemplated there?
And I may add this to Attorney Herrick to address more particularly, but certainly the rule itself anticipates that there can be further hearings which may involve argument on the evidence to determine whether, in fact, the preliminary rulings. Understand, this hearing examiner does not perform a final adjudicative function. So there could conceivably be situations where there would be motions brought to reverse or allow evidence that had not been allowed by the hearing examiner, but perhaps Attorney Herrick could speak more specifically to that.
Counsel, under your definition or interpretation of the statute, that is 5G, you say further rules for the administration of this subsection may be made by the board. The Court of Appeals takes a rather broad definition of what administration is. What would keep this board from delegating the authority to issue the orders?
I think what would keep the board from doing that is to take a look at its responsibilities under 6213 paren 5.
Doesn't it have a responsibility under the statute to also conduct the hearings? And it's delegating that authority? So I don't understand why, if under the broad definition of administration given by the Court of Appeals interpreting 5G, why it can't delegate the authority to issue the orders, to make the decision.
this gets back to the issue of whether the rule is reasonable, and I think at that point in time it would invade the core responsibilities of the PFC, and the court would find it would conflict with the statute itself with respect to that.
Why is issuing a decision more or less of a core responsibility than conducting a hearing if both are responsibilities given under the statute?
I think this gets to the issue of what exactly it means to hear a case versus conduct a hearing. I think at all times it is the PSC that is hearing the case and determining the case. It's using an instrumentality, so to speak, to assist it in gathering the evidence, but the final adjudicative determination is made by the PSC.
That's a very fine distinction, isn't it? To have a hearing is different than having a hearing?
Well, in actual fact, that's been a distinction that's been made by the courts since the beginning of the century. In the Morgan versus United States case that I cite in my brief, the Supreme Court makes a point to say there is a difference between hearing a case and conducting a hearing. And to hear a case means to attend to the facts and the law. It does not mean to physically necessarily keep your ears in the room. And I think that's in keeping with those administrative decisions that again were cited in my brief that are similar to TCASA, which specifically state that it is not necessary for all the board members to actually be in the room to hear and determine a case. So I think going down the line to say that the PSC could not use a hearing examiner would actually call into question, for the limited purpose, would actually call into question the holdings in those cases.
I mean, the statutes referred to by your opposing counsel with regard to unemployment comp, workers comp, work, DWD, LURC, et cetera, it appears, and I'm stating more than I know, that those statutes specifically give to the hearing examining authority to make orders. Is it your position that the authority to make orders, as opposed to the authority to conduct a hearing, has to be expressly granted, and you define expressly granted by meaning, by saying it has to say in the statute that they have the authority to issue orders?
Yes, that's our position.
And you draw that line someplace, and you draw a line between the authority, delegating the authority to issue orders, and delegating the authority to observe witnesses, take testimony, make recommendations, and comment on credibility.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hogg. Mr. Herrick, representing the Board of the Fire and Police Commissioners, the City of Madison.
Mr. Herrick, before you begin, my question was sort of handed off to you, so perhaps you could start with that. Do you want me to restate it?
Yes, let me introduce myself. I am Scott Herrick, attorney for the Board of Police and Fire Commissioners of the City of Madison. And I want to say one other thing in introduction. I want to apologize for my misguided efforts to fiddle with the PA system.
You can speak up, please.
Yes, would you remind me of the question you want me to address?
As I read the rule at issue here, the 7.20, I'm sorry. Yeah, 7.20.
That is the rule.
It delegates to the hearing examiner the responsibility for the initial hearing as well as any hearing, any evidentiary proceedings, any evidentiary hearings that are conducted at all under 6213, and after which the examiner prepares a report, including credibility determinations and a recommendation for disposition to the board. And the board does not necessarily conduct any further hearings. It convenes for deliberation. It retains the authority to require further hearings or to send it back to the hearing examiner for further hearings. But as I read the rule, the board, after receipt of the report of the hearing examiner, convenes for deliberative purposes, not for hearing purposes anymore. Is that a correct reading of it?
Yes. But that final paragraph that you allude to does envision or allow either a remand to the hearing examiner for further proceedings or the initiation, if you will, or the conducting of further proceedings directly by the board. Basically, that's as open as I could get the door to be. In other words, after the board deliberates with the intention, after the board convenes with the intention of deliberating, it still reserves its capacity to do anything in the case.
Sure, but in the ordinary case, the rule contemplates that that board convening for deliberative purposes is not going to be a hearing at which time the board would entertain argument from
That's correct.
Counsel, et cetera. It's a meeting for deliberative purposes only, not for the purposes of the hearing. And so this sort of metaphysical distinction between a hearing and a hearing that your co-counsel was discussing in response to Justice Babish's questions is important here. The subject of the hearing is getting a hearing before the hearing examiner and then a deliberation on that in front of the board, but not really getting a hearing in front of the board.
That is the expectation with the, may I call it, escape clause, that if there is something that arises in the course of a particular matter, that it could go back. And let me
Can the board
also
get briefs from the parties?
The general rules, of which 720 is a part, and the practice of the Madison PFC provides for extensive briefing. Yes, it's a full briefing schedule at the end, and that would still be the case. The hearing examiner would conduct that aspect of the case and any other aspect of the case as the board would do. So there would be briefs, and the deliberations, unless, as sometimes happens, unless the parties stipulate to oral argument instead of briefs.
So you might say, if you were going to make an analogy, that the trial court conducts a hearing and we hear the case?
Yes. I think that's...
But we have rules where you affirm the trial court on credibility and finding of facts, et cetera. I don't see that in 7.20.
You have rules, I'm sorry, but...
Well, the rules of appellate practice, if we are hearing a case rather than conducting a hearing, we give great weight to the prior fact, the person who conducted a hearing. And it seems to me that 7.20 does not give that kind of weight.
It absolutely does not. Absolutely does not.
How can you make that distinction, we hear a case versus conducting a hearing, and I'm paraphrasing the chief, when you have the language in sub 5C that says if the subordinate suspended by the chief requests a hearing before the board. It doesn't say request that the board hear the matter. So isn't that distinction a bit artificial?
It may be. I don't think that I initiated that particular metaphysics, and I must admit I have a little trouble following it.
But if the subordinate wants to speak to the board eyeball to eyeball, may the subordinate do that?
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
If the subordinate, the officer or firefighter, wants to speak directly to the board, I mean, isn't that possible under sub E?
I'm sorry, sub E.
Let's see. Excuse me.
C, I was referring to.
Sub 720E?
Well, it would certainly be possible. That request could be made. I think the whole section of the rule is invites aggressive and creative lawyering. If an attorney wants to propose exactly what you're suggesting, there is certainly room for that to take place. And I need to say one other thing about this rule that's partly in response to other questions. And my yellow light is on. I think I may not get to my prepared remarks. But let me make this comment in that responds to some context here. I'd like you to understand clearly that this rule has never been used. This rule was adopted, and there's a reference to this. If you read between the lines, you'll see it in the statement of the case on page 2 of our brief. This rule was adopted in fearful anticipation of a deluge of cases, which in fact hit the Madison PFC in December of 2000. It turned out to be 7 cases. When we anticipated it, we didn't know if it would be 10 or 20 or 50. And the rule was adopted to provide a mechanism to stick with the statute, the core values of the statute, in the face of that situation. The rule was challenged immediately, and out of caution, the PFC proceeded without the rule to deal with the cases that it faced. So because we didn't want to hear a case under the rule and then face the problem that one of the justices asked about, what about the cases that are out there that have been decided? So there has been no case that has used the rule. But we ask you, please, let us use it when we need it in the future.
Does the board deliberate in open session or closed session?
Deliberations are in closed session. Every proceeding, the evidentiary proceedings, the initial hearing, which is in the nature of a pretrial, all of that is in open session. Deliberations are in closed session. The decision is a written decision, which is issued publicly.
Mr. Herrick, what is your role with the Police and Fire Commission? Do you advise them before they make a decision? Are you in the closed hearing, closed deliberation?
I am customarily in the closed session with the Madison PFC and with other PFCs that I represent, although not with all. That varies with the PFC, but typically I am in with the deliberations. My responsibilities at the hearing stage vary from the indisputably clerical, such as arranging the room and the marginal, like preparing the public notices, advising the board about evidentiary matters during the course of the proceedings. The amount of drafting that I do depends on the board. I can tell you that when Norman Anderson is the president of the PFC, he drafts his own orders. And when Alan Seeger is the president of the board, I draft the orders. It depends on what the commissioners want of me and who they are. When the decision has been made, I represent the decision on appeal.
What's the authority for you to do any of that in 6213?
Well, you're touching on a matter that is of great concern to the PFCs around the state, certainly to Madison PFC, as to how you rule on this matter. The authority to have counsel is in the Stanfield case, Stanfield v. Racine, which is one of my favorite cases because it establishes PFCs sui juris and allows them to have counsel and to act separately from the city. It recognizes that the PFC is a separate entity in the quasi-judicial proceedings under Parent 5, separate from the city. And so that's where we would look to have counsel. But if the PFC does not have the authority to promulgate a rule such as we have here, and perhaps we don't, you tell us if we don't, but when you tell us that we don't, please tell us why we do have the authority to retain counsel, to have a rule about discovery, to have a rule that says we will have initial hearings. Where is the authority to provide for briefing? Where is the authority to provide in our rule to have an answer, a written answer? The statute doesn't say that there will be an answer, but our rule says that we may allow an answer. For all of those matters, we've promulgated rules that have not been objected to over a period of years for the further administration of the section. And my red light is on. I'm sorry.
I have a question. Mr. Herrick, and I apologize if this has been asked by my colleagues. They probably ask it far more artfully than I am about to, and slip me. 6213 sub 5 subsection D. That's what I have reference to here. This, to me, seems to contemplate that the board must have a hearing. And what your rule allows the PFC to do is to circumvent subsection D. And the part that I'm referring to in D is the board shall set the date for hearing, not an administrator, not an examiner, not somebody appointed by the board. The board shall set the date for hearing.
the hearing on the charges shall be public. And so that's obviously referring to the same thing. What 720 seems to me to do is to substitute your hearing examiners for the board in contrary to subsection D. Could you respond to that?
I think the search for explicit, express, word-for-word correlation between 720 or any other rule and the statute is ultimately futile, because it means that the only rule that will survive that methodology is a rule which is a kind of mini version of the statute. I think in order to determine if a rule comports with the statute or not, we have to look to the core values, standards, and structure of the statute. And that's how I would defend in answer to your question. I think there are 8 principles in this statute, including the section D that you, or subsection D that you refer to. They are independent citizen accountability, due process of law, a procedural presumption of innocence, that is to say no penalty prior to a hearing decision, a similar list. You don't want me to continue with my list, and I won't.
And rapidly wind up, but answer Justice Babbage's question.
I presume under the procedures that you've got set down that haven't been used yet, it's not the board that's going to set the hearing. It's going to be the examiner that sets the hearing.
The hearing examiner will schedule the hearing sessions. That is correct.
And sub D says the board shall set the date.
It does.
But you do the hearings yourself if you're not following 7.20. You would set the hearing as the counsel. You view that as a secretarial thing, clerical thing.
Yes, I always have.
And the board, does the board have a secretary?
No. I provide the only staff support to this board. And to my knowledge, the Madison Police and Fire Commission is the only police and fire commission outside of Milwaukee that has an ongoing relationship with outside counsel or staff.
Okay, you ready to wind up? Quickly.
I'll be as quick as I can. The main thing I want to do is to complete that list of the core values.
Okay.
And I've stated independent citizen accountability, due process, procedural presumption of innocence, which means that no penalty is imposed until the decision has been made, open hearings, uniform application as among all complainants, meaning both chiefs and citizens, and also among all respondents, meaning officers of all ranks, promptness and certainty. The recently added element of the 7 standards of just cause, and the ability to make rules for the administration of the section. Those are the core structures and elements and values of 62.13.5. 720 is completely consonant with those. And I appreciate very much your allowing me to conclude that list, even though it leaves me with 2/3 of what I wanted to say.
Thank you, counsel.
Happens all the time.
Mr. Halstead.
Thank you. Just a couple of brief points. First, one that I didn't touch on in my initial time, which relates to the questions that I had responded to Justices Crooks and Wilcox relating to 5G, which is, can you really discern or imply from those the power to employ a hearing examiner? And at pages 15 and 16, because the Court of Appeals obviously, I think, drew the core of its holding from its conclusion that you can rely on 5G to imply a power to employ a hearing examiner. And there are a variety of statutes that I've set forth on pages 15 and 16 of our brief where the legislature not only authorized or instructed administrative agencies to employ hearing examiners, but at the same time gave them the power to adopt rules to administer the statute. And so if the power to administer the statute carries with it inherently or impliedly the right to employ a hearing examiner, then there was absolutely no need for the legislature to include both of those powers. For example, with the Department of Workforce Development, which is given the power to administer the Fair Employment Act and to make, amend, and rescind such rules as are necessary to carry out the statute, but then also explicitly grants the power to employ hearing examiners within the same empowering statute.
I don't notice in that list, Council, the Public Service Commission referred to. Does the Public Service Commission have specific statutory authority to appoint a hearing examiner to delegate to the hearing examiner the authority to conduct a hearing, take witnesses' testimony, administer the oath, and make recommendations?
Justice Bradley, I have not looked at the Public Service Commission statute as I looked at every one that I could find that involved a case that involved the a hearing that implicated a person's employment-related rights being the most analogous, I felt, to this situation. And I confess I can't speak to what the Public Service Commission's statutory authority is or what their practice is or whether, if that is the case, it's ever been challenged, that is, a use of a hearing examiner has ever been challenged. The question, the dichotomy was posed between hearing a case versus conducting the hearing. And Chief Amezcua, her counsel states that it's not the individual's preference whether to have the case heard by the board or by the hearing examiner that's at issue in this case. It's whether the board has the authority or the power to employ the hearing examiner. But the statute under 5C specifically says that the subordinate officer, if suspended, may request a hearing before the board. It doesn't say that that person, that it's at the board's discretion whether to deny that request to have a hearing before the board. It says you have a hearing before the board. And Chief Justice Abramson had commented that, you know, courts can appoint masters, they can hire staffs to do certain things and make recommendations, but I think what is important here is to remember that courts have inherent authority to do things. And those are the types of things that I think a court would have an inherent authority to. An administrative agency's authority is specifically prescribed by, circumscribed by the statute. They have only the authority that they're expressly given or that necessarily must be implied from the statute. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Halstead, and thanks to Ms. Hogg and Mr. Herrick for our second case involving the PFC. The court is in recess until 1:45. The students should remain here, and Justice Prosser will join you in a few moments.